Thanks for listening to the Frontiers podcast. If you have a moment before we start, please rate and follow this podcast. It makes a huge difference. The more of you that do this, the more people get to listen. And the more people that get to listen, the bigger platform I'm building for academics to share their research. Thanks so much. Hi there, you're listening to Frontiers, the podcast that explores cutting-edge research from the world's best scientists. I'm Ian Hallett, and here's what's coming up today. Is there research that helps to explain if you're optimizing for economic prosperity of your nation?
That more trade, and that is to say lower tariffs, makes economies better off on aggregate. But that definitely doesn't mean it makes everyone in the economy better off.
What has been found in the research that you've conducted has either been surprising or unusual?
These kind of red tape costs that the new trade agreements have introduced, they've hit smaller firms harder.
Let's focus it on climate change. Has that hit the research of international trade yet?
The biggest policy challenge in dealing with climate change is the public good nature of carbon emissions. The carbon emitted anywhere in the world contributes to climate change everywhere.
That was Professor Thomas Sampson, an expert on the impact of globalization on workers, firms, and productivity. He's also an associate professor of economics at London School of Economics, and previously an advisor to the Bank of England. This conversation is nothing short of a masterclass in international trade. We go deep into the subject, defining what it is, why it's important, how companies work together, how countries work together, and what big organizations like the United Nations and NATO and the European Union do to enable and sometimes disrupt international trade. It's a fascinating conversation. I hope you really enjoy it. And now I hand you over to Professor Thomas Sampson. Professor Sampson, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
So it would be great to start to get to know you a little bit better. Could you just explain your career journey and your research interests?
Absolutely. So I actually started life as a mathematician. That's what I studied originally. And then I transitioned to economics because I wanted to be able to work on more kind of policy relevant issues and themes. And then my first job when I graduated university, I worked as a monetary policy advisor at the Bank of Papua New Guinea, so in Papua New Guinea in the South Pacific, which was a very, you know, kind of very interesting experience that I feel quite fortunate to have had, to get to see at an early stage of my career the workings of a policy institution from the inside, which gave me, it was sort of fascinating to see how the policy process worked. But after a couple of years of doing that, what I really realized more than anything was how little I knew and how much kind of more I'd like to understand about what was going on. So that then led me going back to doing a PhD, where I ended up specializing in international trade. And once I finished my PhD, I moved to LSE, London School of Economics. I've kind of been there ever since, working on questions related to trade, globalization, and then during that period also Brexit has come up. So I've ended up working quite a lot on issues related to Brexit.
Wonderful. Now I can't resist but asking you, how did you get a job in Papua New Guinea?
So it was under a scheme which is run by the Overseas Development Institute, which is an NGO based in London. So they have this scheme, they call it their fellowship scheme, where they take young economics graduates and they give them positions working within governments in kind of developing countries around the world. So I'd always thought that this would be an incredible opportunity. And I was fortunate enough to be offered a placement in Papua New Guinea. So that's how I ended up there.
Wow. So this was before your PhD. So was it after a bachelor's or a master's that you did?
It was after a master's. So they typically take people who have master's but don't have any other experience. So it's, at that stage of your career, it's kind of a great opportunity to be able to get involved in that kind of work.
Absolutely. And why international trade as a specialism?
Yeah, I mean, I guess when I started thinking about and reading about economics, the question that really grabbed me more than any other was, why are standards of living so different across countries? To me, if you kind of think about it and you compare the, the wealth and opulence that exists in a country like the United States or in many European countries to the, high levels of poverty that we still see in much of the rest of the world, places like India or sub-Saharan Africa. We kind of exist in this world where the country you're born in is one of the main factors that determine the opportunities and the standard of living you have. And I wanted to think about why that was. And when I was starting to think about these issues, I mean, I kind of grew up in the 1990s. That's when I was a teenager. And that was the period where after the first Gulf War, the kind of allied coalition that won that war had imposed these very draconian sanctions on the Iraqi regime, which ended up kind of completely crippling Iraq's economy and their social infrastructure. And I think reading and the kind of seeing that experience left me kind of very interested in how, participating, or in this case, not being able to participate in the international economy affected a country's economy. And so that sort of stimulated my interest, and then it ran from there.
Okay, very good. Now, it'd be great to get everybody on the same kind of level of understanding. So it'd be really helpful if you could explain what is international trade and why it's important.
Yeah, I mean, I think at a very basic level, international trade is simply selling stuff, and that stuff may be kind of physical goods like a TV or a phone, or it may be services like legal advice or financial products. But selling that stuff not within a country, but across national borders. So whenever you're buying or selling something across national borders, we think of that as being international trade. So why does international trade matter? Why is it an object that I think is worthy of study? Well, if you think about what this ability to trade does, is if you're a firm, suppose you set up a firm in the UK and you're looking for markets where you can sell, it creates these new opportunities for you. I can sell not just to people in Birmingham and Manchester, but also to people in Paris or Berlin or Sydney. So from the firm's point of view, it creates new opportunities, and in particular gives the sort of, in a sense, the better firms, the ones who have more attractive products or can produce things more cheaply, it gives them this ability to expand and grow. So it creates opportunities on that side, which not only is good for the owners of the firm, but also creates more jobs. They need to employ more people to produce these whatever stuff it is they're going to sell. And then, whereas as consumers, we probably see the effects of trade more directly is on the import side, which is the flip of the exports. Is importing goods, buying goods from other countries, allows us to buy stuff that we wouldn't otherwise be able to buy. So in the, sitting here in London, it might be that I can buy French cheese that isn't made in the UK, or buy wine from Italy, or we can watch movies that are made in America. So it kind of expands the range of goods and products that we're able to buy. And that, that tends to benefit people in most, though not necessarily all cases.
So this is essentially a part of globalization, which is a broader topic of which international trade is a key mechanism to enable globalization, I should imagine.
Absolutely. It's kind of one of the channels through which economies interact with each other is buying and selling goods across borders. And it naturally is very linked to also thinking about movement of people across borders and issues related to immigration, and then also capital flows, foreign investment, and the behavior of kind of multinational firms who operate in many countries.
It'd be great to get some historical context, because it seems that you have, you could pick any country, but USA and China would be two good examples where my understanding is, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that the trade between those two countries is relatively significant. And that creates, as international trade increases between countries, it creates an economic dependency on each other, which can be helpful for dealing with broader conflicts or geopolitical disconnects or disagreements. So it would be great to understand the history of international trade. And I'm thinking back to the kind of Second World War kind of time and how that's evolved. Is it an enabler for reduction in conflict? And how do we think about that in today's environment where we do have seemingly a number of hot and cold wars that are currently underway?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. I think if we look back to the Second World War and the 70 or so years since then, most of that period, so you know, going from 1945 to around about, let's say, going up to the global financial crisis around 2007, 2008, for most of that period, the overall trend in terms of globalization has been towards increasing integration across countries. So we've seen, you know, countries come together to find ways to reduce tariffs, which are taxes on imports, and tariff barriers have gradually come down during that period. Then we also saw in the 1990s the integration of the former Soviet states into the global economy, which again kind of increased these interdependencies across countries. And as you mentioned, one of the, you know, the biggest changes in global trade, certainly in my lifetime, has been the rise of China from being a country that was fairly peripheral to the global economy to being the world's biggest exporter. So that started around 1980 when China started to kind of open up. And then particularly in the 1990s and 2000s, China, you know, very rapidly transformed itself essentially into being the world's factory. It's the world's biggest producer of manufacturing goods. And that rise of China as a manufacturing superpower, on the one hand, I mean, it kind of very nicely illustrates some of the trade-offs that international trade creates. Because on the one hand, it's brought benefits both for China itself, which has during this period has seen massive poverty reduction, partly as a consequence of its kind of industrialization and its ability to export to the rest of the world. But for other countries, if we think of a country like the United States importing from China, on the one hand, the US has been able to get much access to much cheaper manufactured goods by sourcing from China. That's the reason China has been so successful as an exporter, is it produces most of these goods more cheaply than other places can. So that brings these very direct benefits to a wide range of American consumers. They can get access to these cheaper goods. But then, the flip of that is that for American industries and American firms that produce similar stuff to what is now being imported from China, they've kind of been pushed, a lot of them have been pushed out of business as a result of this increased competition from China. And the people who worked in those industries and the places within America that kind of specialized in this industry. So, for example, furniture is an area where China has kind of now dominates global trade. Furniture manufacturers in the US have just been almost wiped out as a result of this trade. And obviously, if you had set up your career or your business in this industry, that leaves you much, much worse off. So it's kind of it's a nice example of how trade, there are gains from trade, but also there are some people who lose. And then what has happened as a result of the fact that there are these losers is in the last 15 years or so, we have seen a backlash against this kind of globalization. And in the US, this has been most obvious in the trade war between US and China, where despite the interdependencies you mentioned and the fact that the US was very reliant on China trade, one of the the motivating forces behind the rise of President Trump was his opposition to trade with China. And when he became president, he acted on that by increasing tariffs on imports from China. The goal very much being to sort of protect the industries that were wiped out by this China trade. Now, when people have studied these policies, it seems, I think the evidence doesn't really suggest that this protectionist trade policy that Trump has adopted has achieved its goals. But what it certainly has created is this tension, this trade war between the US and China that we've seen in recent years.
So it would be great to do a kind of mini sidebar conversation on tariffs and their role in managing international trade and some of the issues that we've just been discussing. Because I was going to ask you about tariffs and what Trump did as a follow-up, and you mentioned it in your response. So could you explain the role of tariffs in international trade and how important they are to manage? And it'd also be great to understand what the current state is. So you hear a lot, well, particularly the UK government following Brexit, it talks about trying to create free trade agreements between countries, and I'm assuming that means no tariffs. So could you just explain what tariffs are, why they're important, and what the current status is?
Yeah, so a tariff is simply a fancy word for a tax on imports. So tariffs are kind of levied on individual products in the sense that kind of each individual product that's traded will have a particular tariff that the importer imposed. So for example, on cars, you might impose a 10% tariff on cars, which would mean to say that there's a 10% tax on all imports of cars into the country. So what this means a government can do by setting its tariff levels is choose essentially how much more expensive it wants to make foreign goods. Because the effect of these tariffs is to increase the price of goods that are imported into the country. So say, for example, I want to protect the domestic car industry by making it prohibitively expensive to import cars from abroad. One way the government could do that would be to impose a very high tariff, say 200, 300% on cars. And then that would simply make imports of foreign cars too expensive to actually be sold domestically, which would give domestic car producers kind of free rein to capture the entire market. So you could think of tariffs as a way of kind of segmenting markets. If you have high tariffs, you're introducing these wedges between what's going on abroad and what's going on domestically. Whereas by contrast, if you reduce tariffs, you're reducing the cost of imports, and you're helping, the effect of that will be to lead to more integration between the domestic and foreign economy. So, you know, traditionally, and I'm thinking again here back to kind of the post-war period, average tariffs in that period were very high. And then throughout the second half of the 20th century, they gradually declined. And that was because governments kind of came together to negotiate successive rounds of tariff reductions. That's what the World Trade Organization does. It's effectively a forum whereby governments come together and collectively negotiate that they'll all reduce their tariffs. And that tariff reduction negotiations, they were generally fairly successful up until about, you know, the mid-90s. So what that left us with was a situation where most advanced industrialized countries like the US or the European Union had tariffs in the single digits. So fairly low average tariffs, typically somewhere, you know, between sort of 5 and 10%. But then what the recent trade wars have seen, particularly between US and China, is an increase in those tariffs. So Trump, you know, one of Trump's policies was to increase tariffs on a lot of Chinese goods by 25%. So fairly big tariff increases, making tariffs kind of more relevant now than they had been for many years.
And is there research that explains if the role of government, first and foremost, is to the duty of its people? And you know, one of the levers of that is the economic prosperity. So you can see an argument for very high tariffs, which says I'm going to have really high tariffs in my country, import tariffs, because I want to create an economy that's self-sustaining in its own right. I want all of our businesses to serve each other and not to have significant competition from organizations outside of my country. So therefore, I'm going to set the tariffs really high. There's another argument that says actually the way to economic prosperity is to have tariffs really low and have integrated trade agreements between countries. That means that I'm opening up the world's market to the businesses in my economy. Is there research that helps to explain, I know I'm talking about two polarizing scenarios here, but helps to explain if you're optimizing for economic prosperity of your nation, which one's better?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'll start by giving you the one line answer, and then I'll kind of caveat that and explain why it's probably a little too naive to just take the one line answer at face value. But the one line answer is that it is typically the case that more trade, and that is to say lower tariffs, makes economies better off on aggregate. So I think the balance of evidence would suggest that if what you're trying to do is maximize your country's, you know, income per capita, say, reducing tariff barriers is the way to do that. Okay? And now here come the caveats, right? And I think there are two probably most important caveats there. One is that, as we've already touched on, you know, trade typically always produces both winners and losers. So lower tariffs probably make an economy better off on average, but that definitely doesn't mean it makes everyone in the economy better off. So, you know, coming back to the US-China example again, the US as a whole, we think, benefited from the rise of trade with China, but there were certain individuals and firms within the US who definitely lost as a result, you know, particularly those who had to compete with imports coming from China. And, you know, one feature that is important for thinking about the kind of politics of trade policy is that whereas the winners from this form of kind of increased imports tend to be quite diffuse, in the sense that if everyone gets access to cheaper goods, you know, it reduces everyone's shopping bill by maybe a few dollars a week, but it's spread out very evenly across the population. The losers, the people that lose their jobs, or the, you know, industries that get destroyed, or the regions where suddenly the factory that was the main employer in town goes out of business, those losses are much more concentrated. And because of that, it tends to be that the losers care much more about trade policy than the winners. And I think that's why you see the kind of political economy reaction, whereby there's political support for imposing tariffs on US-China trade, for example, to try and protect these losers and protect these industries that have suffered. So that's, you know, that's one important caveat to the statement that in general they're against from trade. The second would be that there may be particular cases where a country can make itself better off by restricting trade in some way. And that, you know, one example where that occurs is if you're able to use policy to essentially make your exports more expensive relative to your imports. So economists refer to that as the terms of trade. A country tends to be better off when its exports have high prices and its imports have low prices. And we've seen an example of that very recently with the increase in energy prices following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. That increase in energy prices is great for energy exporters because it improves their terms of trade, but it's really bad news for energy importers like the UK, for example. So what countries will sometimes do is try and use trade policy to manipulate their terms of trade. And probably the classic example of that would be OPEC, the cartel of oil exporters, who essentially restrict their exports of oil in order to drive up the price of oil. So that's kind of one example of ways of restricting trade to make you better off. But there's kind of other related policies you can adopt that have a similar effect.
Okay, thank you. So it'd be great to get into the day-to-day of your research, your role. So it seems like we already know a lot about international trade, and there's a lot of principles and theory that helps to explain how it works and what's happening. So could you just explain how you go about doing research on this topic, and what are the emerging or hot research areas that you and your peers and colleagues are working on at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, so I think I have kind of two main strands to my research at the moment. One is kind of using large-scale models of the macroeconomy to try and think about how global integration affects kind of the creation, the diffusion of knowledge across countries, and the role that plays in driving productivity and living standards. which is an area that I think we still don't know nearly as much about as we'd like to. And then the other area, which is kind of a hot area for trade research at the moment, is trying to understand more in detail about how different, you know, the detailed microeconomic effects of different trade policies. We've talked a lot already about tariffs, but economists also kind of fixate on what they call non-tariff barriers, which are trade barriers. Well, you know, essentially, any trade barrier that's not a tariff gets lumped into this catch-all non-tariff barrier category. And traditionally, those have been studied less than tariffs. So, you know, what would be a non-tariff barrier? Well, it would be things like customs checks at the border. It would be labor mobility. You know, to what extent can people move across countries for business visits? Is there, you know, regulatory differences across countries? You know, a lot of the issues that tend to come up when thinking about the single market in the EU. So particularly in the context of Brexit, economists have been very interested in trying to understand how important are these non-tariff barriers for trade? We want to think about trade policy. Should we just focus on tariffs? Or is there this kind of other class of barriers that we also need to understand?
Okay, so pick either of the two streams, I don't mind, but it'd be great to understand the step-by-step that you would go about to start researching and understanding these areas. So in practice, what do you do to answer and address some of these questions?
Yeah, this is, I guess that's the question which leaves me tearing my hair out a lot of the time. Exactly how do you kind of find new evidence on these questions? Let me give an example on the from the kind of case of non-tariff barriers. So obviously, you know, the UK recently left the European Union. And as part of that process, it's negotiated a new trade agreement with the EU called the Trade and Cooperation Agreement, the TCA, which sets the terms under which the UK and the EU trade following Brexit. Now, what the TCA does is it's kind of sold as a zero tariff, zero quota agreement. So that means under the TCA, there are still no tariffs on UK-EU trade. And there are also no quotas, which a quota would be a quantitative. You could only trade, say, 1 million cars this year. There are none of those quantitative restrictions either. So if we think that trade policy is just about tariffs, then the TCA in many ways looks exactly like membership of the European Union. So maybe in that case, leaving Brexit wouldn't matter for the UK's trade. On the other hand, what has happened under the TCA is there are lots of new non-tariff barriers to trade between the UK and the EU. So now if I'm a UK exporter and I want to send goods to France, there's a lot more red tape. I need to fill in forms documenting what I'm sending. If it's agricultural food, I need to prove that it's kind of met the requisite health and safety standards. I need to show that I'm meeting EU regulations, which I didn't used to do when the UK was a member of the EU. So there's all this additional kind of bureaucracy firms have to go through. You get checked at the border. It's harder for UK employees to go and do short-term business trips. So one way we can shed light on, you know, to what extent do these non-tariff barriers matter is to actually study what has happened to UK trade since the TCA was introduced, right? So, you know, so coming back to the broader question of, you know, how do we try and do research on these questions? Often it's, you know, the idea is to find a change in policy and then try and study what effect that policy had. Now, if you start thinking about that question, the problem you kind of immediately run into is ideally what you want to do is compare what's happened to UK trade under the TCA to what would have happened to UK trade if we were still in the EU. But obviously that we call it counterfactual of what would have happened to UK trade if we were still in the EU. Because we're not in the EU, you don't observe that. So you will never know what the correct counterfactual is. So a lot of the effort in research goes into trying to find the appropriate comparison for changes in UK trade that allows you to actually identify the impact of the policy rather than mistakenly attributing all changes to say, the introduction of the TCA, when in reality, there's a lot of other stuff going on, broader shocks to the UK economy, the effect of COVID, the effect of the Russia-Ukraine war. You know, trade changes all the time because of all these factors, and you want to be able to isolate just the one factor that you think matters.
Okay, so if you think about the research that you've done, and you can pick any time period because it's quite a specific question, what has been found in the research that you've conducted has either been surprising or unusual in its conclusion that you've conducted in the past recent years or several years?
Yeah, so I mean, let's carry on with the kind of example of the TCA, because we've kind of set that up. So let's carry on and see kind of what we actually found in that work. So when we look at how UK trade with the EU has changed as a result of the TCA, and when we try and disentangle that from other factors like COVID, and we do that by looking kind of at, you know, we use very granular data. So we have data on individual firms' trade, and we compare how at the individual firm level, their trade with the EU has changed compared to their trade with non-EU countries. Right? The idea there being that any shocks like COVID or higher energy prices kind of would affect trade with the EU and non-EU, we kind of expect symmetric effects on those. So by comparing the differential, we can isolate the effect of the TCA. What we find there is that there, you know, as you might have expected, there is a clear negative effect of the TCA on exports on average. So on average, firms are exporting less to the EU. But then when we dig more into that, we see that that negative effect is driven entirely by smaller firms, whereas larger firms have essentially maintained their existing levels of exports to the EU. And I think, you know, what that tells us, which we didn't necessarily expect to see ex ante beforehand, is that these kind of red tape costs that the new trade agreements have introduced have, you know, they've hit smaller firms harder. And in particular, the reason we think they've hit smaller firms harder is if I'm a big firm, I can kind of afford to hire, you know, a department to deal with the new red tape and to fill in the forms and to, you know, maybe I set up a new distributor in the EU. So I pay that cost, but then I can keep trading. Whereas the smaller firms, it's simply not worth making those investments. So they've seen much bigger hits to their trade. And then sort of, you know, thinking about the policy implication of that, you know, what's that telling us today? If we want to think about, you know, future UK trade policy towards the EU, this question of how do you support smaller firms under the new trade arrangements becomes the kind of more important one, whereas larger firms seem much better able to deal with the change in policy.
So that's interesting, because when you say the conclusion, it makes sense. When you give the explanation, it makes sense. But as you say, people weren't necessarily going into this thinking that would be the outcome. But it absolutely, you can imagine yourself in a small organization with 10 employees, you know, if adding one more is a 10% increase in your workforce, that's a big deal to deal with something that wouldn't be probably your core market that you're trading with in the first place. So it doesn't make it worthwhile. So let's build on the Brexit kind of dimension here that you're building in. If you, and I know you studied this area in lots of different ways, but overall, what has been the impact on trade between the UK and the European Union as a result of Brexit? And building on that, as a lot of people today from the kind of more anti-Brexit kind of stance that are saying that they think an answer here is to rejoin the customs union of some form. And I don't have particularly an informed view as to whether that's a good or a bad suggestion, but it'd be great to understand how that fits into the discussion, because that seems to be central to the discussion around Brexit even today, even though it's, you know, many, many years after people voted for it and a few years after it actually happened.
Overall, what we've seen as a result of Brexit is a decline in the UK's trade with the EU. For UK exports, as I mentioned, that's been concentrated among smaller firms. So the kind of aggregate effect has been relatively small, just because larger firms drive most of the trade in the EU. But what we are seeing is smaller firms reasonably small firms, they may have seen a 20, 30% drop in their exports to the EU. And as a consequence of that, some of the, you know, the very smallest firms have stopped exporting to the EU altogether. So that's been the effect on the export side. On the import side, the aggregate effects have been larger. We've maybe seen about a 25% decline in UK imports from the EU relative to imports from the rest of the world. And that import side decline has been more evenly spread across different firms and seems to at least have been partly driven by firms substituting away from EU import and instead sourcing goods from the rest of the world. Now, what does that imply about, you know, what future UK trade policy might look like? And in particular, this question about should the UK think about rejoining a customs union? I think there were sort of two elements of EU membership which boosted trade. One was being in the customs union, and the other was being part of the single market. And you can think of the customs union as being the key thing for reducing red tape at the border, whereas the single market was more about often harmonizing UK regulations with EU regulations, increasing market access in that way. I think what the evidence we have so far suggests is that it's probably more of the border red tape, the stuff that really matters to small firms, that has mattered for trade more than the single market access. So the conclusion from that would then be that potentially rejoining the customs union would help to undo a lot of the trade costs of Brexit that we've seen so far. Now, I want to be a little bit cautious about that because, you know, Brexit is still a work in progress. The trade is still adjusting to the new arrangements. And if UK and EU regulations diverge over time, that's likely to introduce additional trade costs, which will be more linked to single market access. But at least the shorter run effects, I think a lot of them are linked to the kind of barriers which rejoining the customs union would remove. So from that, you could make the case there that rejoining the customs union would be beneficial.
So you mentioned the 25% reduction in imports from the EU and that much of that has been substituted by imports from other countries. But has there been a net increase in home-produced goods to offset some of that, or has it been entirely sourced from countries that are non-EU now?
That's a great question, and I wish I could give a better answer than I'm about to. The problem with answering that question is that when goods are traded, you know, governments collect very detailed data on international trade. So we know a lot about how much trade goes on. We know less about exactly what products are being produced within a country. And now that might seem somewhat strange. You might expect that we would kind of know more about what's going on within the economy than when things cross borders. But exactly because of these tariffs we talked about earlier, and because tariffs are a source of revenue from the government, they have an interest in really measuring when goods cross borders. So we know at a very detailed level what's happening to international trade, and we know at a much less detailed level what's happening to domestic production. So I would expect that part of what has happened when we import less is that firms buy more goods domestically, but we don't have the data to show that that is definitely happening.
Okay, great. Presumably that's a research area that lots of people are working on.
Yes, when I first moved back to the UK, I kind of first started at LSE in 2011. And at the time, you know, sort of international trade was kind of a bit of a dead field in the UK because we'd been members of the EU for 40 years. We didn't have our own trade policy. Nothing was going on in trade policy. And then suddenly Brexit happens and, you know, it's the dominant political issue. And that has really driven a kind of massive growth in interest in trade in the UK, which has been, you know, very interesting for me, but it means there's now a lot more people working on these questions.
So it'd be great to switch topics now. So what I've noticed on these conversations that I'm having with other researchers from all sorts of different disciplines, it's almost impossible not to have a conversation about climate change and sustainability. And which is encouraging that so many academics of different fields are now integrating that thinking into things that you wouldn't conventionally consider to be necessarily connected. A good example is I met with a professor at the University of Zurich, and he had done some research on whether or not investors care about biodiversity risk. It was a really interesting piece of research that he had done, which you wouldn't normally expect a financial economics professor to be doing work on. Not, but normally now, that's but 5 years ago or 10 years ago, you wouldn't. So where does, let's focus it on climate change, because I know it's obviously a massive, massive topic on it in its own right. Has that hit the research of international trade yet? And how does that, and assuming it has, how does that actually manifest in the trade agreements and the research questions that people are thinking about asking?
I think it probably hit about maybe 2 or 3 years ago. There was a big shift towards more people doing work on climate change. And now I think in some sense, you might think that that's a bit worryingly late. And it's probably fair to say that economists have maybe been a little late to the party in terms of really focusing on climate change. But it's definitely happening now. In my field, so in international trade, where the research questions around climate change, a lot of them are linked to the issue of how you encourage governments to cooperate in addressing climate change. Because, you know, as you know, that probably the biggest policy challenge in dealing with climate change is the public, you know, what economists call the public good nature of carbon emissions. The carbon emitted anywhere in the world contributes to climate change everywhere. And because of that, individual governments, if they're only thinking about their own people, their own nation, they don't take into account how domestic carbon emissions affect foreigners. So that very naturally creates an environment where, in order to address those problems, you need governments to kind of come together and care not just about their own people, but also about the rest of the world. And that's what agreements like the Paris Agreement, where countries come and kind of pledge to make emissions reductions, that's what it's trying to achieve. It's trying to get them to internalize these spillovers across borders. So in international trade, what people have been thinking about is whether there is a role for trade policy and for tariffs in incentivizing countries to cut carbon emissions. So probably the most prominent example there is the policies which are called carbon border adjustment mechanisms, CBAMs, which is, you know, something the EU is proposing to, is planning to introduce in the next couple of the years. And the idea of the carbon border adjustment mechanism is that if you import goods that are produced using carbon that is, you know, cheaper, less regulated, where there are weaker carbon climate change policies abroad than in the domestic economy, you charge an extra tariff on those goods in order to kind of equalize the carbon prices across countries. So it's a way of trying to get importers in more countries that produce more carbon to have to shoulder some of the burden that your domestic producers will also will pay. So there's a lot of interesting work going on currently thinking about how do you design these CBAMs in a way that encourages kind of maximum participation and that kind of provides an incentive for countries to adopt more policies to address climate change.
It's quite interesting because if I think about it from a business's perspective, and one of my remits in my position in my day job is I own the supply chain, the global supply chain of the company. We're in 128 countries, so it's quite a complicated thing to piece together. I also own ESG, so I own our kind of environmental footprint, which is logical that you'd have the same person, only those two things in our situation. Now, the emissions factors that you use in order to calculate your carbon footprint are, and you know, for listeners, it's essentially you increase the impact of some emissions of or some carbon impacting activities are worse than others, and you have to factor up those that are worse compared to those that are not so bad, and that gives you an overall footprint. And that actually makes you think very hard about the choices that you make about the impact on the environment of your company. Like, you know, you want to switch from gas to green electricity somehow, if you can, in your footprint, because the emissions factors are so significantly different between the two. So that sounds analogous to what you're talking about with having some sort of factoring on different countries. And it's like we have something in place that others can work from. I'll stop talking in a moment, but I've got another thing that I wanted to add on to it. The other part to it is that when the Scope 3 emissions, which are those emissions that are calculated that are in your supply chain, become a reportable item, which I think is in 2026, suddenly the impact of your supply chain and therefore your international purchasing matters a lot. That means that already organizations like ours are asking our suppliers to demonstrate that they have sustainable practices, that you think very hard about the physical locations of where they're purchasing and how much transportation is involved and all those things. So it'd be great. So that's the kind of the business market that will have most likely a very significant impact on international trade. And even if the agreements that you're describing don't take place. So it'd be great to connect the two together. Is there a logical connection between one driving force, which is organizations being required to be more sustainable in nature, which is a government policy thing, an investor thing, but also you've got these international trade agreements that are kind of, as you described before, is there a connection taking place, or are these two things working in parallel but for seemingly similar objectives?
I think that the hope, as in the hope of the people who are designing these policies, is that there should be a connection. In the sense that, you know, when they introduce these, you know, carbon border taxes, you could imagine two different ways firms and governments around the world might respond. One is that firms, in order to avoid paying these carbon taxes, might reorient or reorganize their supply chains in a way that they source inputs that are less carbon intensive. So, you know, there would be a very direct connection between, you know, the issues you were talking about are related to supply chain management and the effects of these carbon border taxes. So, you know, that's one possibility. Another possibility is that the response comes not from firms, but from governments, and that rather than firms reorganizing their supply chains and, say, sourcing from countries where production is less carbon intensive, the existing more carbon intensive countries that they source from adopt policies to reduce how much carbon is produced in those countries. So, for example, by raising the price of, you know, carbon domestically, or by encouraging kind of clean tech investments in those countries. And I think, you know, this is a very, you know, these are new policies. They haven't been introduced yet. And we don't really know what the margin of adjustment is going to be. The goal is clear. It's to reduce carbon emissions. But it will be fascinating to see whether that occurs through firms kind of shifting where they source inputs, or through governments changing their policies. I don't think we know what's going to happen yet.
No, absolutely not. The one data point example, which is me at the moment in this conversation, we are genuinely changing where we're sourcing from, with an eye on the Scope 3 impact of the overall organization. We've made a commitment to be net zero by 2040, like a lot of other organizations have. Whilst that might sound like a long time away, to re-engineer your supply chain, it takes a really long time to do that. So it's a very present conversation right now, and I'm absolutely sure it is from colleagues in other organizations that I speak to that is also it's not an unusual thing that we're doing. So this has been a really fascinating and actually very educational conversation. So I appreciate you taking the time to do it today. Do you have a final kind of message or topic that you'd like to cover that you think our listeners would be interested in or you'd like them to hear?
I mean, I guess if there were kind of had sort of one takeaway from all the different topics I work on, is the high levels of interdependence that exist in the global economy today. There is so much international exchange, not just of goods and services, but of people and of capital, that if we want to understand the world we live in and to think about, you know, what policies we might want to address, you always need to take into account the international dimension. So I think kind of keeping in mind that complexity and the fact that because a lot of the effects of a lot of policies, as we've just been talking about, spill over across borders, we need to think about ways in which countries can find ways to cooperate rather than to kind of bicker and fight. And there's a lot of global problems. Climate change is probably the easiest example, which are only ever going to be solved if countries cooperate.
Absolutely. Where can we find out more about your work?
Everything I write and publish is available on my website, which if you Google Thomas Sampson, it will show up and you can find all my work there.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thanks again for such a really rich conversation on international trade and lots of other topics today. So Professor Sampson, thanks for your time today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you so much for listening. To support this podcast, please follow us on whatever platform you're using. It makes a huge difference. Thank you again. Hope to see you next time.